This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Last week, President Bush announced his latest economic plan, which would cut taxes by $670 billion over the next 10 years. He expects over half that money to come from the elimination of the tax on stock dividends, which is the centerpiece of his proposal. He calls the current system double taxation because corporations pay tax on their profits, and then when they pass on some profits to their investors in the form of dividends, those investors pay tax on that money too. What the president presented as a simple plan may be more complex than it sounds. My guest, Floyd Norris, is the chief financial correspondent for the New York Times. He points out that the Bush proposal doesn't eliminate taxes on all dividends. It's only on dividends issued by companies that have paid enough federal taxes. And many profitable corporations avoid paying taxes through loopholes or creative bookkeeping. Norris expects that if this proposal passes, there will be many complicating factors.
It's going to be very complicated. Companies are going to have to disclose when they pay the dividend. And the details haven't all been worked out here. Congress will, you know, may not accept this at all, may amend it a lot. But presumably, Congress will set up a provision whereby companies will have to disclose when they pay the dividend, whether it's taxable or how much of it is taxable. And that will be a revolution. For the first time, it'll be possible to easily figure out how much tax a company is actually paying. And after that's been going for a couple of years, it's going to be clear which companies are paying taxes and which are not. And in some future Congress, if we have a Congress that's looking for ways to raise revenues, they might end up taking a look at some of these companies, some of these industries, and saying, this industry is profitable, it's paying no taxes, why? And then we'd see some of the corporate tax loopholes that have come into the system over the years, often with little public attention. We might see those loopholes start to get closed.
Would you describe this as an unintended consequence of the proposed dividend tax break?
I don't know whether it was intended. Certainly the administration has not discussed that at all. Now, this is largely based on a 1992 Treasury study done during the administration of the first President Bush, this tax plan. And that study did discuss some of those effects, so it was not unknown to the people who came up with this, but it certainly is not a selling point they've gone for.
Okay, I'm a little confused. Say you invest in a company, the company is profitable, it pays taxes, therefore your dividends are tax exempt. A couple of years down the line, you still own your stock in this company, but now the company's losing money, therefore it's not paying corporate income tax. So what happens to your dividends? Now do you have to start paying taxes on those dividends?
You certainly may. It depends on how they fine-tune the plan. One thing they're considering is allowing companies to carry over some of these profits so that next year's dividend would be paid out of not this year's taxes, which there were none of, but last year's taxes. They're also considering not allowing that. If they don't allow that, companies would be distributing a different tax benefit the first year, which would mean enable investors to get lower capital gains taxes when they sold their shares. But yes, it's quite possible that one year a company's dividends would be tax exempt and the next year they'd be taxable.
So it seems to me it's going to make investing maybe a little more complicated because it adds a lot of guesswork into this.
There's plenty of guesswork already. And yes, it will cause some shocks to people when they discover that a dividend they thought was going to be tax-exempt is not.
Since the only dividends that will be tax-exempt are the dividends of companies who pay taxes, is there a chance this might lead to more, shall we say, creative accounting on the part of corporations?
Well, what's going to be very interesting is to see if this does prevail, what happens in the Congress. But the way the Bush people have written the provision, there's only one loophole for that, and that's for taxes paid to foreign governments. Otherwise, it's pretty simple. If you write a check to Uncle Sam, you can pass on some benefits to your shareholders, and it's a simple relationship. The corporate tax rate now is 35%. So if your company writes a check to Uncle Sam for $35 million, that means that they had $100 million of real taxable profits they reported. Therefore, the remainder of that $100 million, $65 million, they can hand out in dividends. And that arithmetic is actually pretty simple. You write the check, you get the benefit. You don't write the check, you don't get the benefit. And in that regard, that is one of the few simple things here. There are some other things that make this complicated. So I don't think you're going to see creative accounting in that way. You might see some creative accounting in people buying and selling foreign tax credits, which is a complicated area that I don't think we want to get into the details of. You might see some of those games being played. I don't know.
The Bush plan brings a new concept forward, and that is the deemed dividend. What is that?
The deemed dividend is something that relates to a company that could pay tax-exempt dividends but chooses not to do so. It's paid taxes to the government, but it wants to reinvest the money in its business. The argument was that it's not fair to let a company that hands out the cash to its investors have a tax break for them, but to not let a company that reinvests the money have a tax break. And the solution to that under the Bush proposal is called a deemed dividend. Here's how it would work. Let's say that the company you own stock in has the ability to pay out $50 million in tax-exempt dividends, but chooses not to do so. And it chooses not to do so because it wants to reinvest the money. And to make life real simple, let's assume there's 50 million shares of this company, meaning that that works into exactly $1 per share. What it can do instead is pass out the deemed dividend to you, and that would enable you to raise your basis in the stock. Now, that sounds all complicated, but what it means is if you paid $40 a share for your stock and they handed out a $1 deemed dividend, when you got around to selling your stock, you'd report not that you paid $40, but that you paid $41 for it. And if you sold it for, say, $50, that'd mean you had a $9 profit to pay capital gains taxes on instead of the $10 profit. And that would give you a tax savings, just like it would have given you a tax savings if they'd paid the dividend.
A lot of people who invest in the market invest through their retirement plan at work. And those plans are tax deferred. So will they get any benefits from the dividend tax cut?
They get no direct benefits. Now, the advocates argue they'll get an indirect benefit because this will drive up the prices of stocks, and of course, therefore, it will drive up the prices of stocks in their portfolio. So if that happens, they get that benefit. But directly, they get no benefit. And in fact, were this to become law, this would present an argument for an investor to put his stocks, if he has both a retirement plan and a regular taxable plan, it'd present an argument for an investor to put his dividend-paying stocks not in his retirement plan, but outside of it. The way it's going to work is an investor puts money into his 401k at work. And that 401k, the money is not taxed going in. That's a great advantage for the investor. Eventually, he'll withdraw that money from the 401k after he retires. And all of that money is going to be taxed. And it's going to be taxed at ordinary income tax rates. Now, that may be a lower rate because your income may be lower when you retire, but it's going to be taxed. And that will be true regardless of how the money got into that plan. Regardless of whether the profits in that plan came from capital gains or from dividends or from interest on bonds, or whether it's just the money you put in to begin with on a tax-deferred basis and you didn't make much in the way of profits over the time it was in. So therefore, investors, I think, will want to consider trying to own more stocks outside of their retirement plans if this becomes law.
My guest is Floyd Norris, the chief financial correspondent for the New York Times. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Floyd Norris. He's the chief financial correspondent for the New York Times. How much money will the government lose in taxes if dividends are no longer taxed?
They claim that it would be something over $300 billion over the next 10 years. This number is a guess. It may not be an especially good guess. These 10-year projections are often ridiculous. And one of the sad things about this administration is the games they have played with the 10-year projections, both in the previous tax bill they passed last year and now in this one, where they're not fixing up something they vowed to fix because it would cost too much money in the 10-year number. But this one is even harder to estimate because nobody's done a study. Nobody knows what proportion of corporate dividends come out of profits on which taxes have been paid. And therefore, nobody knows what percentage of dividends now being paid would be tax exempt, let alone how this would change behavior of corporations. And corporate income taxes have withered away in the last 20 or 30 years. So it's possible that this would, as I explained earlier, have an effect of increasing that. So that number, that $300-odd billion, could prove to be an exaggeration. And, of course, it could prove to be an undercount as well.
How is the Bush administration justifying a $300 billion tax cut just on the dividend tax break alone at a time when we're facing the possibility of a very expensive war with Iraq and the possibility of a very expensive rebuilding and democratizing period after the war?
The answer of how they're justifying it is they talk about stimulative effects from this package. Critics question how much economic stimulus there is. They talk about encouraging investment, which would help get the economy moving. Businesses now are not investing much money. And the reason they're not investing much money is because they don't see much opportunity for profit. There's massive overcapacity in certain industries, most notably telecommunications, and this wouldn't do anything about that. But mostly they're arguing that we need this, and they're not focusing on budget issues. Some people suspect that President Bush remembers that Ronald Reagan passed a massive tax cut early in his administration. It led to huge, unprecedented, in fact, unthinkable budget deficits. Deficits that he denied would ever happen and that happened. But that he became a wildly popular president, was reelected in a landslide in 1984, and would have been reelected again in 1988 had the two-term limit rule not prevented him from running. On the other hand, the man who did win that year, President Bush's father, was persuaded by people who cared about deficits that he had to raise taxes in 1990. And he did raise taxes, breaking a campaign pledge, and 2 years later he was defeated. I think this president is far more worried about his political popularity and about the economy and about being perceived as helping the economy than he is about running some deficits.
What do the people who are in the middle class or the lower middle class get from the Bush tax program?
Not a lot. They get this particular program. It will accelerate reductions in individual income tax rates. The tax bill they passed last year, or I guess it was 2001, provided for gradual reductions in rates over the next 7 or 8 years. And this will accelerate those reductions, so they will all come immediately. That means virtually everyone who is paying income taxes will pay a little less. That will have some stimulative effect, probably not a huge one.
What are some of the things that people in the middle class and the lower middle class might lose if there are lots of tax cuts and a bigger deficit?
Well, arguably that drives interest rates up, making it harder to borrow money. That effect is arguable. Basically, they'll end up, you know, they and their children will pay higher taxes in the future to pay off that deficit. But the real issue I think the Democrats are focusing on is a proposal that was kicked around, supported by a number of politicians of both parties, tending to be the more liberal Republicans, for a temporary, perhaps 6 months, perhaps a year, reduction in payroll taxes. Now, payroll taxes are the Medicare tax and, more importantly, the Social Security tax. And collectively, they raise about as much money as the individual income tax does. But this is not a progressive tax like the income tax. It's a regressive tax. Low-income earners, most middle-class earners, people who make up until 80-some thousand dollars this year, and it goes up every year, will pay Social Security taxes on all of their wages. Rich people pay Social Security taxes on the first 80-some thousand of their wages. They don't pay it, however, on other income. They don't pay it on dividends. They don't pay it on capital gains. And the result is that they pay a lot less in these taxes as a percent of their income than do poorer people or middle-class people. The Medicare tax does apply to all of the income, earned income of people, but again, doesn't apply to dividends or capital gains. What had been suggested was a six-month or a year moratorium on the first $10,000 of income on Social Security taxes and perhaps Medicare taxes on that income, with the government making it up, just appropriating the money out of the general treasury. That would serve as a real benefit to lower-wage people. They'd get a lot of money back that they wouldn't otherwise get. They'd save some real money. For upper-income people, they'd get a little money back, but it would be de minimis relative to their income. The effect might have a lot of stimulus, and the reason it might have a lot of stimulus is the simple fact that poor people, if you give them a tax break, are more likely to spend the money. Obviously, if you're a millionaire, an extra $20 a week in income is more likely to be saved simply because you're already buying what you basically think you need. If you're just getting by, that $20 a week may very well go into another pair of jeans for the kids or something, and that has more stimulative effect on the economy.
Now, President Bush has also, since he was elected, emphasized the end of what he describes as the death tax, the estate tax. What's the status of that now?
The status is a fascinating one because in the first tax bill they passed, they gradually phased out the estate tax. So if you're a very rich person, your estate will pay less in estate taxes if you died this year than had you died last year. It'll pay less if you manage to make it to 2004, and so on each year until in 2010, if you die, there will be no estate tax. However, under the current law, in 2011, everything reverts back to the way it used to be. Suddenly, the estate tax will go up to the level it is, not this year, but the level it was a couple of years ago before they passed that bill. Individual income tax rates will also go up to those levels under this bill the Bush people passed. Now, this has provoked a lot of dark humor. I call it the Dr. Kevorkian bill. Because, of course, if they don't change it in 2010, and you are very rich, it is conceivable that your children or your grandchildren will be discussing this with you and pointing out to you that, you know, if you really care for your grandchildren, were you to die before the end of 2010, they'd end up a whole lot better off than if you managed to make it to January 2011. This is, of course, a ridiculous situation. The reason it happened before was that they were under pressure from a few liberal Republicans in the Senate to hold down the size of the overall tax bill the first time around. And the way they accomplished that was to assert that in the 10th year there would be no cost. The 10th year in that calculation was 2011. And therefore, they could make the overall 10-year numbers add up, and 10-year numbers under the current budget rule are what people count. This is all, of course, completely ridiculous in real life. Now, it was taken for granted that in a new tax bill, they would fix that up and make those cuts permanent. Say that in 2011, the rates that were in effect in 2010 would remain. But they didn't do that. And the reason they didn't do that was they didn't want to have this bill appear to be costing too much. So they still got all this flip back in 2011 coming out. Now, the assumption everyone makes is that some future Congress will fix this, and that if the estate tax is repealed in 2010, they'll find a way to keep it repealed. But, of course, now the Bush administration is not excessively worried about 2011. He'll run for re-election in 2004, and if he wins re-election, the president who will have to deal with that will be the man who's elected in 2008. And that, by definition, will not be George W. Bush.
Floyd Norris is the chief financial correspondent for the New York Times. He'll be back in the second half of the show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with Floyd Norris, chief financial correspondent for the New York Times. We're talking about President Bush's plan for cutting taxes. As we're facing paying less in taxes, particularly less in dividend taxes, there's the possibility of another tax that the middle class would have to pay more on, and that's the alternative minimum tax, which is, I think, a pretty confusing tax. It was one that was meant to make sure that the wealthy paid taxes and didn't get around taxes with a lot of loopholes. But it's a tax that's increasingly affecting the middle class. Can you explain why?
Yeah, the alternative minimum tax was meant to assure that people who were using the tax code to deduct taxes would pay something. And the idea was you compute your taxes two ways. First, you compute it with all the deductions that they've allowed, and you take your tax rate that is in the code. Then you compute it again, and you throw out a lot of deductions, and you compute it with a lower tax rate, and you pay whichever number is greater. This, of course, confuses people who don't have accountants something fierce. What we've seen is gradually, as incomes have crept up, more and more people fall into this. It's especially a problem in the high-tax states of the Northeast, because one of the preferences is the deduction you get for state and local income taxes. Right now, if you pay $5,000 in state income taxes to New York or Pennsylvania or whatever, you get to take that as a deduction from your income on your federal income taxes. But for alternative minimum tax, you don't get to take it as a deduction. And the result is that more and more people are paying AMT. In addition, because they reduced the rate on ordinary income but didn't reduce the AMT rate, your ordinary income taxes will now be lower under the bill that they passed 2 years ago and then the bill they're passing this year or that Bush wants them to pass. But they haven't changed the AMT, and so more people would discover, well, my ordinary rate came down, but my AMT rate didn't, so I'm not saving any money. Now, what the president has proposed here is a temporary fix on the AMT. He'll raise those limits a little bit. And that'll mean some people won't go into AMT. But again, that's only a 1 or 2 year tax break. And the reason it's only that short a period is that if they made it permanent, it would make the 10-year numbers much bigger than they think is politically palatable. So they didn't do it. Again, there is an assumption that a future Congress will have to do it.
The estimates are that the president's proposed new tax plan would cost over $600 billion, close to $700 billion over the next 10 years. What's the estimate of the deficit that we will have 10 years from now if this plan goes through?
I don't know, and I pay no attention to those. You remember a couple of years ago, I'm sure you had people on your show who were learnedly discussing the surpluses that were going to last for years and years and years.
Correct.
And, you know, they were wrong. 10-year deficit forecasts are nonsense. They are based on all kinds of assumptions, and they're really not worth the effort that goes into producing them. What we've learned since then was that a terrific amount of government revenue at the federal level and at the state and local level was dependent on the bubble in the stock market. Individual investors, corporate executives, who were cashing in those stock options, in some cases for hundreds of millions of dollars, were paying huge amounts of federal taxes and in many cases large amounts of state taxes on the profits they made from those options. The budget forecasts had not incorporated that kind of money coming in. And so suddenly the budget forecasters were grossly underestimating government revenues. And this went on for several years. Their solution was to assume that there was a permanent increase in government revenues. They didn't understand why it was happening, but they said, hey, it's happening. We'll assume it's going to happen all the way into the future. And then the bubble burst. And, of course, they're not collecting profits on their options anymore. Certainly not the kind of profits they were collecting before. And so now you've seen state and local revenues and federal revenues fall sharply below what was forecast. And that's going to continue for a few years. Will it revive? Hey, you're asking me, is the stock market going to go up? And then what will be tax laws? That's what you need to do to get these estimates, and they're not worth much.
Are the Democrats united in an alternate plan, an alternate tax plan?
By no means. Nancy Pelosi, the new Democratic leader of the House, has put forth some ideas. She has the support of many Democrats, but because everyone knows there's no chance of passing her plan, they aren't too concerned about the details of it, as they would be if she were in a position to perhaps push a plan through Congress. The Democrats, I think have learned that running against tax cuts is not a productive thing. They've also learned something, they're beginning to learn, that there's something to be said for aspirational voting. And that is to say that if you look at the circulation of magazines that focus on yachting or something, a lot of them go to people who don't own yachts and who reasonably are not likely to buy yachts anytime soon. But some of them enjoy dreaming of perhaps being a person who could afford a yacht. And some of these people, it appears, vote based on their aspirations as much as their current condition. And the Democrats attempting to appeal to organize the middle class to be appalled by the breaks of the rich haven't done that well, because a lot of the middle class hope they're going to be rich someday.
In conclusion to our conversation, I would like to say this. I think there is such a fundamental paradox when it comes to taxes in the United States. Politicians are always running on taxes and tax cuts and so on. Taxes are always such a big issue in elections. But when you read the fine print of any kind of new tax code or tax break, it is so confusing and is so hard to tell in the long run how much you as an individual will benefit or lose by this. Everybody wants to hear they're getting a tax cut, but nobody has the patience to really comprehend what it means.
That's true. Russell Long was a senator from Louisiana who ran the Finance Committee in the Senate for many years, who had this line, "Don't tax you, don't tax me, tax that feller behind the tree." It is true. People want to avoid paying taxes themselves. They also want all the government programs, and they also want a balanced budget. And to some extent, the politicians who are successful are the ones who manage to define the issues. If the issue is, do you want to pay less in taxes, you can guess what the answer is going to be. And to some extent, that's been the great success of President Bush. He's defined that as the issue, and he's gotten the answer you'd expect.
Well, Floyd Norris, thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you.
Floyd Norris is the chief financial correspondent for The New York Times.